for those of you who are listening to this recording, just so you know, I recorded part 8 of my series on Genesis at the UC Merced in fall of 2023, and unfortunately, lesson number 8, I didn't record it correctly, so I'm re-recording it. So this is not the live version, but hopefully it'll be pretty close. Started right by reminding them what we've covered so far. We saw the first 11 chapters of Genesis, the story of the creation, God's creation, Him creating the world good, and then creating us to be in a relationship with Him, to be in His image. How in Genesis 3 through 11, it describes the fall of mankind, how God had given us a choice. He put the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the garden, and Adam and Eve chose to reject God's provision for them and instead wanted something better. They ate from the tree of knowledge and they fell. They lost their privileged place with God. Then the story of Cain and Abel, the story of the Tower of Babel and the hubris of humanity, how the cycle of sin goes from bad to worse, and then finally to the judgment where God decides to judge the world. And if it were not for the righteousness of Noah, none of us would even exist at all. God would have ended everything. That's how bad it got. But remember, Genesis is the story of the fall of mankind, but also the story of the beginning of God's plan to save mankind, which culminates in Revelation chapter 21 and 22 when we go back into the garden. So remember, I made a point and I said, again, this is my opinion. You don't have to agree with me, but of all the characters in the Old Testament, other than God himself, who is the chief important person in this story of God's plan? The answer, as the student said on Wednesday night, it's Abraham. Abraham is the one through whom God's plan worked. Abraham was made righteous by faith. Abraham was faithful. And because Abraham was faithful, God was able to make a covenant with Abraham, the covenant of circumcision. God gave him his promises. He gave him many promises that he would have, that kings would come from him, that that his wife Sarah would give birth to a son, that that through him all nations would be blessed, many nations would come from him, that he would give him the land, and many other promises like that. And it's not like Abraham was perfect. Oh, not even close. I mean, there's this situation when he went down to Egypt where he didn't exactly lie about Sarah. He said, she's my sister, which technically she was his half-sister. We see him also showing a lack of faith when God said in Genesis 17 that you'll have a son a year from now. And at that point, Abraham was 99 years old and Abraham laughed. And yet, Abraham showed many signs of great faith. He did, in fact, leave everything behind and Haran, and he lived in tents for the rest of his life. Abraham gave up the good land to Lot and took the lesser land in the hills. Abraham showed great hospitality to the angels that came to him. Abraham pleaded with God for the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah. We saw the incredible intimacy of the relationship between Abraham and God as he asked God, oh, what about 50 in Sodom and Gomorrah? What about 45? If not 45, what about 40? Then what about 30, 20, and even 10? And God was willing to change his mind because of the influence of the man of faith, Abraham, and the relationship that God had with him. And in the end, though, there were only how many righteous in the city? 4, I guess. Lot, possibly his wife and his 2 daughters. And so even though God overthrew the city, he saved Lot and his children. But Lot, you know, we saw in 2 Peter chapter 2 where God says something about Lot, which is pretty amazing. He called Lot a righteous man. And as we looked at Lot last week, we saw that Lot does not really come very high up the scale of righteous people. That's encouraging to me. Even though Lot just barely made it out of Sodom, only because he was dragged out of there. And even then he said, no, let's just go to Zoar. I don't want to leave far from the sinful life. I just want to go a little ways from the sinful life. Despite his lack of faith, God called Lot a righteous man. That's encouraging. But then we looked at the example of Lot's wife. She represents those who have left Sodom, figuratively have been saved, and yet she looked back, she was turned to a pillar of salt, and she lost the opportunity for salvation she had. So that's leading us up to this ultimate example of the faith of Abraham. We finished off in Genesis 17, and yet we'd already looked at Genesis 19 and 20. So let me just make a couple more comments, all right, about Lot, and then we'll move on to Abraham and what happened there. You know, Lot said, oh, it's not so bad. It's not going to be so bad. Was Lot a righteous man? No, but God remembered Abraham, and because he remembered Abraham, Genesis 19:29, for that reason he saved Lot. And it reminds us in Genesis 8, verse 1, in which God remembered Noah and brought salvation to all his house. And what about your faith? The effect that your faith can have even on your own house. But in the end, Lot becomes the father of both the Moabites and the Ammonites. And ultimately, Abraham's descendants become the progenitors of at least five nations. Ishmael, the father of the Arab nations. Lot, the father of the Moabites and the Ammonites. Esau, the father of the Edomites. And then, of course, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the father of the Israelites. So God was faithful to his promise. At the end, though, we find Lot living in a cave in abject fear. He left Abraham with great wealth, but he had an accommodating attitude towards the world. Because he was willing to accommodate with the world and find a compromise with the world, he lost almost everything that was important to him. Now, what I did last night then is I did a brief little archaeological aside before we got into Genesis 22. So I talked a little bit about the archaeological evidence that supports the accuracy of the Bible as an historical account. And in order to do this, you might want to possibly go to my website, which is www.evidenceforchristianity.org, or even the church website, mercedchurch.com. Find the PowerPoint for Genesis. Skip down to the slide. I don't know how many slides is down. It's what I'm talking about a lot on Genesis 17 or so. And there's about half a dozen slides on archaeology and Genesis. So having a picture here might help. So let me talk about some of the archaeological evidence that seems to support the idea of Abraham, the story of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Laban, and all those being accurate history. By the way, we will never find an actual archaeological find, a statue, a building, or anything like that to prove the existence of Abraham. Because honestly, once Abraham left the city of Ur, he lived the life of a migrant, essentially. He lived in a tent. So we will never find physical proof of Abraham himself. But what I want to show is that everything we know about the book of Genesis, chapters 11 through 50, fits the genre, fits the situation of Mesopotamia in the years 1800 to 2000 BC. All right, for example, it describes Abraham as being born in Ur. And as you read about Ur in Genesis 11 and 12, you see that it's a large and prosperous city. In fact, the city of Ur has been found, it's been dug up, it's been studied extensively archaeologically. The evidence says it was probably the largest city in Mesopotamia in roughly 2000 BC. And then we see that Abraham went from Ur. He didn't go to the promised land right away, right? He went to the city of Haran. And if you have the PowerPoint up, you can see pictures from the ruins of the city of Haran. And in the account of Genesis, Haran seems to be sort of north and west of Ur, and it seems to be between Ur and the Promised Land, and it seems to be more or less on the frontier of Mesopotamia, which is in fact true. And the interesting thing about Haran is it was destroyed and abandoned in 1800 BC. Now, the enemies of Christianity, of the Bible, who are trying to teach us that the Bible is not reliable history, they'll tell us that this whole story about Abraham, Jacob, Isaac, Sarah, Rachel, Rebecca, Joseph, these are all just stories, made up stories, made up by Jewish leaders that want to teach their children to obey their parents, stuff like that. Well, if that's true, if Abraham was, as the skeptics and critics say, was written around 500 or 600 BC, then how do they explain the fact that Haran had literally not existed for 1,200 years? How would somebody writing in, say, 500 or 600 BC even know anything about the city of Haran, all knowledge of which had been disappeared for way over 1,000 years? Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Now, there are a lot of other sort of detail kind of things that we find from the history of the Near East. For example, if you go to the next slide, if you're in the PowerPoint, we see one of the Ebla tablets. Ebla was a fairly large city in what would be a northeast Syria today. And in Ebla, they found several thousand tablets, something like 10,000, 15,000 tablets in the cuneiform script. And most of these tablets are things like lists of supplies and trade and laws and death records and things like that. But one thing to note, and this is from, by the way, roughly 2000 BC, roughly the time of the events of Genesis 12 through 50, four of the names found on the Ebla tablets are Nahor, Terug, Abram, and Sarai. It just so happens four of the important figures in this period, in Genesis, especially 12, 13, 14, and 15, are named Nahor, Terug, Abram, and Sarah. Now, I'll tell you right now, these people that are mentioned in the Ebla tablets are not the biblical characters. No, not at all. The point is this. Nahor, Terug, Abram, and Sarai, these were common names. Where? In Mesopotamia. When? Roughly 2000 BC. Roughly the same time frame of the characters in the book of Genesis. And again, if the book of Genesis was some sort of a fantasy, some sort of story made up, maybe by, I don't know, Moses or some, you know, some Israelites and during the time of Joshua or the Davidic time, or even more likely, as the critics would say, during the time of the divided kingdom, then how would they have ever heard of people like Nahor, Terug, Abram, or Sarai? It'd be like somebody wrote a letter. Yeah, I was visiting a friend. I was at a college campus yesterday and met Harriet and Harold and Gertrude. Yeah, they were over there. You go, no way. That's not possible. Another kind of cool one, all right, it's found in Genesis. The story about Laban chasing down Jacob. I don't know if you've read the story. It's a pretty interesting, it's awesome story, actually. It's in Genesis 31. What happens is Jacob, of course, he goes to Mesopotamia, to Laban's home there, to find a wife. And first he has to work 20 years and he gets Leah. He's not impressed with Leah. He wanted Rebecca, so he works for 20 more years, and he gets Rebecca. Then he works for 20 more years, and finally he's able to leave with great, great wealth, camels and donkeys and sheep and goats and all this sort of stuff. And then Laban chases him down all the way into the wilderness, not to get his daughters back, not to get his grandchildren back, not to get his sheep or camels or goats back, but to get the household idols. What a strange story. But then archaeologists found in the Nuzi tablets, Nuzi, another city in the northern part of Mesopotamia, and one of the Babylonian laws from roughly 2000 BC was this: whoever possessed the household gods inherits all the family property. All right, now it makes sense. Nothing in Israel's later history, nothing in Egyptian history or Greek history would even suggest this idea that Laban would chase after not to get his daughters or his grandchildren back, but to get the household idols back. And that's what happened. Again, this historical, factual detail from Mesopotamia, from roughly 2000 BC, shows the source material for these accounts in Genesis are indeed from the proper place and the proper time. Okay? A couple other things that are worth noting. For example, in Genesis, there's the story, in Genesis 14, the story of Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, who comes from Elam, which is actually east of Mesopotamia there, and he comes in and he attacks, he makes war on the kings around what we would call the Dead Sea. And there is a league of five cities, Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, and Zoar. And these five cities, along with Lot, by the way, they have this battle north of Galilee, kind of near the Golan Heights. And at this battle, Chedorlaomer defeats the five cities. And then Abraham, he intervenes. He brings his people there. They chase them down. They catch them there by the city of Dan. You can go there. The gate of Abraham is still there even today. And he takes back the booty. He comes coming back. He talks to Melchizedek, as we saw last week. But here's the deal. If you go to the Dead Sea today, there's a reason they call it the Dead Sea. It is desolate. There's almost nothing there. The idea of having farmland there seems ridiculous. And yet, in the biblical account, in the time of Lot in Genesis 14, Abraham and Lot are up in the Judean hills, and Abraham looks down at this verdant farmland down there in the around the Dead Sea and says, Lot, you go down to the really awesome farmland, and I'll stay up here in the not-so-good farmland. All right, so the critics, again, as usual, the critics of the Bible would scoff at the very idea of these cities and this great agricultural land in the Dead Sea. But it just so happens that in the 70s and 80s, one well-known archaeologist decided, you know, hey, let's go down there, let's do some looking around. What they found is in 2100 BC, 2100, somewhere in that range, turns out not that the Dead Sea was a verdant, tropical, humid paradise. It was quite dry, but there were a number of wadis. These are seasonal streams that come down canyons into the Dead Sea area. Turns out at that time they flowed all year long. And what was done is the residents there produced a very major system of agriculture using irrigation. In fact, he found a number of cities. Guess how many cities the archaeologists found? You got it? Five. In fact, if you're looking at the slide, you can see the northernmost one, known as Bab Ed-Dra, is almost certainly the biblical city of God, of Sodom. And here's the interesting thing. All five cities were destroyed by fire somewhere around 2100 BC, and none of them, indeed the entire area, was never occupied by cities ever again up till modern times. Again, we see archaeological evidence, which doesn't prove Abraham specifically or Lot either for that matter, but it shows details that are dramatically supportive of the biblical account, which if Genesis were written, you know, 1500 years later, there's no way anybody would possibly have had this kind of knowledge. Here's another little additional tiny little fact. Turns out at the city of Bab Ed-Dra, which we call Sodom, about 1.5 kilometers east of the city, there was a large graveyard. And in the graveyard were these wooden hut-like structures that were used for their graves, I guess. And the evidence was that these wooden structures burned not from the bottom to the top, which is what happens when you burn down cities. Indeed, they were burned from the top to the bottom. Proof of the fire and brimstone would be too strong a statement, I would say. But I would say this strongly supports the biblical view of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay, last little archaeological tidbit that, oh, by the way, if you go a couple more slides, you can see some of the actual ruins from the actual city of Sodom. Next, you see a picture of an ancient city that's found in central Turkey today. This regards to the Hittites, and the Hittites were one of the peoples that that were there in the area of Canaan. There's the Hittites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, the Gershonites, the Jebusites, and all these other ites. Of all those, the ones that seem to have the most power, the most influence in the area, were indeed the Hittites. In fact, the Hittites are mentioned 47 times in the Old Testament. And yet, up until the early 20th century, there was literally no archaeological evidence for the existence of these people. So, not surprisingly, those who seem to make a living from trying to question the historical reliability of the Old Testament declared the Hittites to be not real, not true, a fantasy, a made-up story, as were the Girgashites and the Hivites and the Jebusites and all those. And then, the year 1906, Hugo Winkler discovered the city of Hattusha. It was a large city made up of several acres, and it turns out since that time, a number of Hittite cities have been found, dozens of them, of which Hattusha was the largest. And indeed, it turns out what's now been discovered is that between the years 2000 and 1800 BC, the three major powers in the Levant, in the area of Canaan, were the Egyptians in the south, the Assyrians in the east, and then the Hittites in the northwest. In fact, if you go to the next slide, you can see the extent of the Hittite Empire at its greatest extent. It covered almost all of what we would call Turkey today, plus parts of Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq. In green, you can see the Assyrian Empire at that time, which later became larger, and you can see the Egyptian Empire in yellow. So, again, the biblical description is in a perfect alignment with archaeological evidence that's been revealed. As a Christian, I'm not the least bit surprised by this, of course, but those who are skeptics of the Bible probably should take note. All right. Now, this takes us to what I really want to talk about. Oh, by the way, there's a picture of the Lion Gate in Hattusha. I actually believe the Hittites are real. You can actually get a major at a couple of different universities in Hittite studies. And by the way, I believe the Jebusites, the Gershonites, the Girgashites, and all these other rites, those two are real actual people that actually existed in the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as the Bible describes. I believe it. All right. Now let's get to Abraham and Isaac. I love Genesis 22, the story of Abraham and Isaac. And the picture here is a picture, a foreshadow of events in the time of Jesus. What I'm going to do is, let's go to Genesis 22. I'm going to start reading, starting in verse 1. It says, sometime later. Now, sometime later is something like 13, 14, 15 years later. We don't know exactly how long, but at this time it appears that most likely Isaac, who was born when Abraham was 100 years old, is now a teenager. All right, and so remember that God had said to Abraham multiple times in Genesis 12, Genesis 15, Genesis 17, he'd said that I'm going to give you a son, and through that son, all nations will be blessed. You'll have descendants like the stars of the sky and the sand of the seashore. Kings will come from him, and all these other promises. God had promised that Isaac is that son. But then we see in Genesis 22, God asks Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. Now, as I read through this account, I want you to notice the parallel between the relationship between Abraham and Isaac and how that relates to an important figure in the New Testament. I'm purposely not going to tell you. Let's see if you figure it out as we go along. So, sometime later, verse 1, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, here I am, he replied. Then God said, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. Go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you. Early in the next morning, Abraham got up. He loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and he saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you. I'm guessing there's a pretty good chance you've kind of figured out what we're talking about. In fact, if you read in 2 Chronicles, I don't think I have the reference here, but in 2 Chronicles, it tells us that Mount Moriah, that's the city Jerusalem is built on. Mount Moriah is where the temple was built. So God asks Abraham to sacrifice his one and only son on the same mountain that God willingly offered his one and only son as a sacrifice. And let's think about Abraham. And let's think about God. You know, we in our Bible talk this just a couple days ago, and on Tuesday we were studying from Isaiah 53. Actually, it was last week, where it says, it pleased God to crush his son. God willingly gave up his son. And as I did Wednesday night, last night, when we were together and going over this lesson, I pointed out there's a couple of fathers there. One of them is Francisco. I said, Francisco, if God asked you to kill your son, what would you say? I mean, you're a disciple, right? You said to God, I will give up everything I have. I will put you above everything. I'm a disciple. Would you kill your son if God asks you to do that? And Francisco, of course, said no. And I agree. I would rather, honestly, if God asked me to kill my own son, I'd rather go to hell than kill my own son. This is the faith of Abraham. But also, we have to understand, this tells us not just a lot about Abraham. It tells us a lot about God. God was pleased. Now, he it's not like he wanted to crush his son. But for our sake, he loved us so much that he gave his son. And he caused him to be killed for our sake. So God asked Abraham to do this. And you have to understand the situation Abraham was in. Because on the one hand, Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. Yes. Abraham had said, through Isaac, all nations will be blessed. Through Isaac, kings will come. Through Isaac, you'll have descendants like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. And then God commands him, kill your son. The promise was going in one direction, and the command was going in the exact opposite direction. What would the man of faith do? Again, I want us to be amazed, blown away at the faith of Abraham. And this explains why God chose Abraham. Because the story of salvation is the story of salvation by faith. Look at the faith of Abraham. And what's it say in verse 3? Early the next morning, Abraham got up, he loaded his donkey, took his servants and his son Isaac, and he headed to Mount Moriah. Heavy heart, don't you think? Because from that perspective, the moment Abraham set out for Moriah, his son was as good as dead. Notice this. It is not a coincidence. On the third day, notice this, verse 4. On the third day, Abraham looked up and he saw the place in the distance. Because it says in 1 Corinthians 15, I believe it's starting in verse 4, this is Paul's summary of the gospel, that the Messiah must die according to the scriptures. I got that. Isaiah 53, Psalm 22, Zechariah 11, sure. And then he says, and then the Messiah must be crucified and then raised from the dead on the third day according to the scriptures. Where's this prophecy that the Messiah would die and then be raised from the dead on the third day? The answer is Genesis 22, verse 4. And by the way, also Jonah, chapter 2, verse 1, where Jonah also was raised from the dead on the third day. And even in Esther, where on the third day, God saved Esther, who offered his life, saved her from death. All right. So anyway, they go to the mountain of Moriah. And they arrive there, and notice this. Let me start in verse 6. Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering, and he placed it on his son Isaac. He himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father, Abraham, Father? Yes, my son, Abraham replied. The fire and the wood are here, Isaac said. But where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told them about, Abram built an altar there. He arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac. He laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand. He took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Better words no man has ever heard. Abraham, Abraham. But I want us to look at the details here. Notice this. They arrive at the mountain, and Isaac carried the wood up Mount Moriah that was going to be used for his own sacrifice. Can you think of another son? Of another only son who carried wood up the same exact mountain that was going to be used for his sacrifice? That's Jesus, who carried the crossbeam up the mountain to his crucifixion site. And I believe there is great symbolic meaning in the fact that Abraham, who is God in this story, Isaac is Jesus, Abraham is God, that Abraham carried the flint knife that was going to be used to kill his own son. Now we're up on the mountain, and to me, really symbolically, we're now in the Garden of Gethsemane. Because Isaac says to Abraham, Dad, I see the wood, I see the fire. Where's the ram? Where's the sacrifice? And Abraham says to him, Son, you are the sacrifice. How do you think Isaac felt at that point? What emotions are going through his head? Father, what are you talking about? Impossible. I'm the promised son. You love me. What? You brought me here to kill me? And notice this, it says, He tied his hands, right? He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar. So what do you think? A 115-year-old man wrestled his son to the ground, held him face down and tied him up? I don't think so. Now, this is my own version of events. Take this with a grain of salt. But I think Isaac said to his father something like this. Not as I will, as you will, Father. Go ahead. Anyway, and then we know what happened next, the wonderful ending. Because unlike the second Abraham who gave up the second Isaac, the father who offered his son, unlike in that story, God called back Abraham's hand. Verse 12, he said, do not lay a hand on the boy. He said, do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you've not withheld from me your son, your only son. Abraham, the man of faith. Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over, took the ram, and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide." And to this day it is said, "On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." Jehovah Jireh, the Lord will provide. The angel of the Lord called Abraham from heaven a second time, and he said, "I swear by myself," and these are the very words of God to Abraham, "I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this, and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed." And there you go. That's the story of Abraham. And notice this. God says to Abraham, "I swear." Why would God swear anything? Well, he'd already made this promise to Abraham several times. But because of Abraham's faithful obedience, he believed in spite of the promise. In spite of the command, he believed God's promise. Because of Abraham's faith, God says, "I swear. I swear to you that your descendants will be like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore." Let's go to Hebrews chapter 6, where we see the Hebrew writer recounting this situation of God swearing. Because why would God swear anything, right? Doesn't really even make sense. You would think that if God said it's true, that'd be good enough. No. God knew that Abraham needed great, great assurance. Just like he knows that we need great assurance of our salvation. So beginning in Hebrews 6, verse 13. "When God has made his promise to Abraham, since there was no one greater than him to swear by, he swore by himself, saying, 'I will surely bless you, and I will give you many descendants.' So after waiting patiently, Abraham received what was promised." People swear by someone greater than themselves, and the oath confirms what is said and puts an end to all arguments. Because God wanted to make the unchangeable nature of his purpose very clear to the heirs of what was promised, he confirmed it with an oath. God did this so that by the two unchangeable things, which are him and his word, by the way, by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled to take hold of the hope set before us may be greatly encouraged. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain where our forerunner Jesus has entered on our behalf. He's become a high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. And God says to us, disciples of Jesus, "I swear, there is an anchor behind the veil in the Holy of Holies. And anchors, folks, they don't move. That anchor is Jesus Christ, our high priest." If God promises you that you have eternal life, then like Abraham saying, God saying to Abraham, "I swear, you have descendants like the stars in the sky and the sand and the sea." Similarly, God says, "I swear to you, O disciple of Jesus, that your place in heaven is secure." That's the beautiful story of Genesis 22. So if we want to, as Paul admonished us in Romans chapter 4, if we want to follow in the footsteps of Abraham, we need to do two things. Number one, like Abraham, we need to leave everything behind. Abraham left Haran, and he lived in tents, in something which was just a foreshadow and a picture of the inheritance that he would later receive only through his descendants. But if you're a disciple, arguably, I think almost by definition, you've already done what Abraham did. You've already left everything behind. you've already given up everything to become a disciple. But not only do you have to follow Abraham out of Haran, Genesis 22, if you want to walk in the footsteps of the faith of Abraham, you need to follow him to Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah is the place where you give up the blessing. God has given you something awesome. He's given you a wife. He's given you a family. He's given you a church. He's given you your health, whatever he's given you, whatever blessing. And God says, for the sake of the kingdom, I'm going to take it away. And like Abraham, we willingly go to that mountain and we willingly give up that thing. And God says, I swear, you have a home in heaven. So that's the story of Abraham in chapter 22. Now, we're not quite done with Abraham. We're really close. We've got just one brief little episode. And this is Genesis 23, a story you could read and just pass it on without realizing the symbolic importance of what happens in Genesis 23. So Sarah dies there in the beginning of the chapter. And Abraham goes on. Let's pick it up in verse 3 of Genesis 23. Then Abraham rose from beside his dead wife and spoke to the Hittites. There are those Hittites, the ones that I believe in. He said, I'm a foreigner and a stranger among you. Sell me some property for a burial site here so I can bury my dead. The Hittites replied to Abraham, Sir, listen to us. You're a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choices of our tombs. None of us will use you his tomb for burying your dead. Then Abraham rose and he bowed down before the people of the land, the Hittites. He said to them, If you are willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me and intercede with Ephron, the son of Zohar, on my behalf, so you'll sell me the cave of Machpelah, which belongs to him and is at the end of his field. Ask him to sell it to me for the full price as a burial site among you. So Abraham purchased the cave of Machpelah, and the field outside. So basically, God said to Abraham, I will give you all the land, everywhere you set your foot. And like it says in Hebrews 11:13, Abraham received only a picture of what lay in the future. For him, he received a postage stamp-sized piece of land, a tiny parcel, in which he was buried later on, along with Sarah, and along with Isaac, and Rebekah, and Jacob, and Rachel, and Leah, and yes, quite symbolically, Joseph as well. So basically, God's giving this little plot of land as a statement about the future. And Abraham, as usual, trusted God. And later on, God called Jacob out of Egypt to be buried there. And then over 400 years later, as you can read about at the very end of Genesis, but then later on in Joshua, you find out that God also called Joseph out of Egypt. His bones were carried and buried in the same cave. Later on, God called Moses out of Egypt. And then later on, he called Israel out of Egypt. Hosea 11:1. And later on, he called his son Jesus out of Egypt. When he was born, because of the persecution of Herod, he went down to Egypt. And out of Egypt, God called his son. And out of Egypt, God calls you and me. Because we too were slaves to sin, as the Israelites were slaves. But out of Egypt, God called his son. And all of them were buried symbolically, but also in reality, in the cave of Machpelah. All right, we're almost done. We just got a little bit more. I want to start with the story of Isaac, which we'll do very, very briefly, and then with the story of Jacob. Now, Isaac is a relatively weak figure, really, in the Genesis story. Isaac does go and Laban, and he finds Rebekah, and he marries Rebekah. But really, the Genesis account tells us relatively little about Isaac. Chapter 24, Abraham was now very old, and the Lord had blessed him in every way. He said to the senior servants in the household, the one in charge of all that he had, put your hand under my thigh. I want you to swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I am living, but will go to my country and my own relatives and get a wife for my son Isaac. And Genesis 24 is the miraculous story of how that happened. All right? And then Abraham dies. And then his wife, as Sarah, his wife is, Rebecca, is barren. And God miraculously gives Rebecca children. So let's go to Genesis 25, starting in verse 19, and let's learn not so much about Isaac, who, like I said, was a fairly weak figure, but really, as we get into Genesis 25, we're seeing the second major figure here, which is that of Jacob and Esau. All right, so there's the story of Ishmael and Isaac, of course, as you know, but let's go to Genesis 25, starting in verse 19. This is the account of the family line of Abraham's son Isaac. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel the Aramean from Paddan Aram, and the sister of Laban the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord, and on behalf of his wife, because she was childless, the Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, and let's see if you can see the foreshadowing, the prefiguring going on here. Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. And when the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment, so they named him Esau, which means hairy. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob, which means grasp the heel. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. So, you know, Isaac was a fairly weak head of the household. We get the sense that Rebekah was kind of running things. She ran the show. He was a somewhat absent father out, you know, hunting, left things behind. Anyway, Rebekah gets miraculously pregnant, and even during her pregnancy, her two sons are fighting. They're constantly at odds, even in her very womb. And God says, these two sons are two nations, and those two nations are Edom, the Edomites, of whom Esau was the father of the Edomites, and then Jacob, the younger son. Now, in the normal situation in the ancient world, which son inherited the promise and inherited the double measure of the inheritance? Always the older son, never the younger son. But there's this story, and the story is really about the Gentiles and the Jews. Because in this story, Esau is the Jews, and Jacob is the Gentiles. Now, if you were to ask a Jewish person, all right, who are you? Are you Jacob or Esau? Well, they would say, we are Jacob, obviously. And according to the flesh, it's true, because they're descendants of Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. They are Israelites. So physically, they're descendants of Jacob. But spiritually, according to Hebrews and several other New Testament statements, no. The Jews who do not put their faith in Jesus, they are the children of Esau. And in fact, we are the child of promise. We, and it says this in Romans chapter 9, and also in Malachi chapter 1, where it says, Jacob I loved or Esau I hated. Now, did God hate Esau? Of course he didn't hate Esau. God chose Jacob. By the way, the passage in Romans is Romans 9, 10 through 13. God chose the younger to shame the older. God chose the Gentile to shame the Jews who didn't accept him. And so we see this fight, which was born out in history. The Edomites and the Jews rarely were cooperating. They generally were fighting with each other. It's not that God didn't love Esau. Are you kidding? God loved Esau. He blessed him. He gave him many descendants. He was extremely wealthy, and he was the father of the entire Edomite nation. But nevertheless, spiritually, God chose Jacob. And the story of Jacob is interesting, because Jacob started out not so great. I mean, he deceived his father. He cheated his son. He comes across as kind of a double-crossing, two-timing, manipulative person, as was his mom, by the way, to some extent. And yet, Jacob ended up awesome. We're not going to get that far today. We're going to see that Jacob grasping the heel of his brother. All right, that's true, but he also grasped onto the angel, and he refused to let go. He had great faith. He said, "Bless me, God. Give me the blessing." And because of the faith of Jacob, as well as the faith of Abraham, God was able to bless him and to give him many sons, and through him to bring the Messiah. So there's great symbolism in this relationship. And then they grow up, and it didn't get much better. Verse 27, the boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was content to stay at home among the tents. You know, Esau was a man's man, and it's not too surprising that Isaac preferred Esau over Jacob, who, you know, is kind of a soft edge. He's hanging out, cooking food, and nothing wrong with men cooking food, by the way, that's awesome, but I think by the ancient world standards, probably Esau is not exactly a man's man, let's just say. All right, but anyway, Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew, that lentil stew. I'm famished." That is why he's also called Edom. He's known as Esau, which means hairy, and Edom, which means red, because of the red lentil stew for which he sold his inheritance. Jacob replied, "First, sell me your birthright." "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "What good is the birthright to me?" But Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and he drank, and then he got up and left. Really? Would anybody sell their birthright for a bowl of lentil stew? Jesus asked in Luke 9, would anybody sell the whole world gain the whole world in order to forfeit their soul? And the answer is, oh yeah. People will sell their soul for a one-night stand. People will sell their soul for a diploma. People will sell their soul for one night's pleasure. Yes, this is not as shocking as you think. And if you go to Hebrews chapter 12, in fact, let's go there. We're almost done, but I wanna go to Hebrews chapter 12, because I wanna leave us with this lesson about Esau, who serves as a strong negative warning to us. Hebrews 12, verse 14. "Make every effort to live at peace with everyone and to be holy. Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one falls short of the grace of God, and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. See to it that no one is sexually immoral or is godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold his inheritance rights as the oldest son." He had the right, as did the Jews, and yet he sold it for a bowl of stew. Afterward, as you know, when he wanted to inherit it, his blessing, he was rejected, even though he sought the blessing with tears. While the prophetic meaning of this is quite scary, because if we become children of God and we sell our inheritance, if the Holy Spirit leaves us and we fall away, we will not be able to be renewed to repentance, as it says in Hebrews chapter 6. So, two nations are in the womb of Rebekah, correct? Israel, Edom. Edom representing the older son representing the Jews who refused Jesus, Jacob, the younger son who should not have received the inheritance, who God loved and God chose. Jacob sells his birthright. Esau sells his birthright. And I want us to think about how could we very foolishly be like Esau, who would sell the amazing inheritance we have with God for something of very little value. Now, we're going to continue the story of Jacob, where he seizes the blessing and he has the reunion with his brother and all that stuff. Probably we're going to finish the Genesis account within 1 week, maybe two, probably one. But that's it for tonight. Thanks for coming, and our recording is done. Sorry if that recording wasn't quite as good as the live version. It's really tough, but I hope it was worthwhile. All right.